This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
You guys do that?
No.
I'm going to talk through this entire thing. The people will know your crimes.
This can't be aired.
Oh, but there's a really good question this week, actually.
That's on you.
The deck of many things still suffering.
The Eldritch Lorecast does not condone decapitation.
Sean's question is retreat mechanics.
Is this a good time to mention that I genuinely don't like apes?
Here's my question about Cinderella. Why did her shoe not just disappear?
There's like a couple silly things that you won't like because you don't enjoy fun. But
that's the news.
All that and more right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms. That's right, this is an absolute textbook intro for this podcast, lacking a little bit of energy, but that's okay, because it's going to be a good episode. I can tell. I can already tell.
We're going to back you up, then. We've got the energy. You don't need the energy. We've got the energy.
Oh, my God. Somebody's let James off the leash.
Like a kangaroo has just fallen into our camper van.
Oh, God.
But for those that don't know, my name's Ben Byrne, here with Sean Merwin, Dale Kingsmill, James Hake. And James, with all your energy, I've got to ask you first, what do you really like about horses?
Well, Ben, I got to tell you, the greatest thing about horses is just they've got four legs and they run. They've got all the energy. They've got so much energy. Humans cannot tame the energy out of them. In fact, some horses have got so much energy, they got to be taken back behind the barn and shot because they got so much energy.
Whoa.
I think this persona needs to be taken.
Let us not upset anybody else here on
the barn.
yeah. Calm me down for a second. Just shoot me with some horse tranquilizer and I think I'll be okay.
Dale, I know you're super excited to answer this question, so I'll let Sean go first. Sean, what's your favorite thing about horses?
When you hold them.
Okay. In what way specifically?
You've never heard the expression "hold your horses"?
I was just imagining just a tender little hug around the neck.
Too. All right, Dale Kingsmill.
There's so many horses. At least in my branch of the planet, you go for a drive, you got to see a lot of horses. It's not just a couple of horses. It's a lot of horses. Okay, and I don't understand why there are so many because people aren't using them for their farm work anymore. People aren't using them for travel anymore, but there are so many horses. And it's not out at a riding track. You've got a field with eight horses in it. People will tell me, Dale, there's a racetrack nearby. And I'm like, yes, but people travel to the racetrack with their racing horses. I see them on the road. They get in my way. So why are there so many horses?
They exist solely so people can drive by, point, and go, horses!
I need people to understand. Do not take this as me saying that there shouldn't be so many horses. I would just like to understand the how and the why of the thing.
I have a terrible joke for you that I've known since childhood. I think you'll appreciate this joke, which is a guy breaks down in a field or breaks down on the side of the road next to a field, and he opens his car and it's all smoking and he doesn't know how to fix it. And he turns and there's two horses in the field. There's a brown horse and a black horse. And he looks at him and he says, what am I going to do? As he looks back down at his engine and he hears, no, check the radiator. And he looks up and the black horse like winks at him and like kicks its head. And he looks down and sure enough, it's a bit loose. So he tightens it up and his car's repaired. And he's like, oh, geez, that's amazing. Thank you, black horse. I must go tell someone. And he gets in his car. He's so astonished that this has happened. He gets to the pub in the closest town. He gets out, he says, everybody, you won't believe the most amazing thing has just happened. I was broken down by the side of the road and there was a field with two horses in it and the black horse told me how to repair my car. And the bartender said, that is amazing because that black horse doesn't know anything about cars.
So a horse walks into a bar and orders a drink and the bartender says, why the long face?
Okay. Wait, I've got a good horse story for you. So a horse walks into a bar, and the bartender puts a glass of water kind of like next to another guy and sort of brings the horse over to it. And the horse doesn't drink a drop because you can lead a horse to the glass of water, but you can't make him drink.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Michael J. Pastor asks, what game cons are you going to this year or would like to go to, even if your plans aren't quite locked in yet?
I don't know any game cons. I don't know any of them. I don't remember them. It'll come up and it'll be like 2 weeks out and people will say, hey, you're going to the thing. And I'll be like, ah, the thing? That's my ongoing experience of cons.
Can confirm that is my ongoing experience of Dale Kingsmill attending cons. Sean Merwin, what about your very fine self?
Winter Fantasy next week, Gary Con in a couple of months. Ooh. Origins, followed by Gen Con, followed by Gamehole Con, followed by PAX Unplugged. And boy, do I really want to go to Big Bad Con. It's just a long flight, and boy, do my arms get tired.
Ooh, I mean, is that your wish list, or is that all the ones you are attending?
Oh, probably all the ones I will be attending. And, you know, PAX Australia is what I really want to go to as well. Don't think it's going to happen this year, but I really, really want to.
That's an even longer flight.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. Yes.
That is quite the wish list. You've hit a couple of my wish list ones. James Hake, what about yourself?
Yes. I would love to get the whole lore cast at Gen Con. Gen Con, I'm always hesitant to do, but if we can get the four of us in one Gen Con together, you can bet your butt I'm going there. I think I'm going to skip PAX Oz this year. I'm going to stay close to home for PAX West instead, right? Because I heard at Unplugged this year that PAX West is kind of turning its tabletop scene around. I stopped going to my own Seattle-based PAX West because all the D&D up in smoke vanished. But it sounds like it's coming back in a big way. I do miss my local con. I've got a lot of nostalgia for it. It's the first con I ever went to back in 2008. I would love to go again. And PAX Unplugged, always. And Big Bad Con. I missed it last year. Desperate to go back, because truly between that and Unplugged, I can't decide which is the best con of the year for me. Big Bad rocks. It's so worth it, Sean. You should get on a plane for it. You absolutely should.
Well, in that case, maybe.
Yeah, Big Bad's also on my wish list. I think confirmed Ghostfire is going to Gen Con. We'll definitely be there with a stall and be running games. PAX Australia, which is in October, for those that were asking in the chat before, we will definitely be there because it's just a drive down the road, mate. We just take it, throw it in our ute, and down we go. I would love to go to PAX Unplugged again. And possibly Gamehole Con as well, kind of on my wish list, but can't confirm those. But I did find out, sorry, that we're going to be at Conquest, which is at Easter here in Melbourne. It's a small little gaming convention, but it's getting bigger every year. So if you want to play some Grim Hollow, we will be at Conquest running games on the Saturday and Sunday there. So feel free to come say hi. Speaking of further Ghostfire gaming news, we just put out a video on the main channel 2 days ago, kind of announcing a couple of things that we've got coming up in the year. First being our first Kickstarter this year being Monsters of Drakenheim, which is coming in March. Monty and Kelly talked a little bit about that book in the video. It's a monster compendium, but it's also they're kind of endeavoring to provide more than just stat blocks and a little bit of lore with each monster. I believe they want to include also their own kind of take on a crafting system using the bits and pieces that you take from monsters. And they also want to include lairs for those monsters as well. So it's going to be a bit more of a utility book for you to craft entire adventures out of with more than just the stat blocks in there, which is exciting. If you want to know more about that, maybe go follow the Dungeon Dudes on YouTube, because I have no doubt they'll be giving all the details very soon. We'll probably have them on here sometime soon in March. To talk all about that. And then, and this is the one I'm excited for, not that I'm not excited for Monsters of Drakenheim, is the Grim Hollow. We've got our next Grim Hollow Kickstarter coming in October. It is a little whiles away, but I am in constant panic mode because we're going to try something a little bit different this time, which is to try to provide. I know how much everybody on this podcast... Everybody say, hell yeah, for playtest packets.
Hell yeah, for playtest packets.
That's right. That's what I want to hear.
No, I'm very excited for Ghostfire playtest packets. I've been raising the Ghostfire playtest banner for 18 months by this point, so I'm happy to see it happen. Tell us about it, Ben.
Well, look, everything's up in the air a little bit at the moment because we're trying to plan this, as we're trying to get it out to people. But what I can say at the moment... is the first playtest packet we want to have out in the next little while. I don't want to put I don't want to put too much pressure on our team, honestly. But we're planning to have one out in the next, let's say, 2 to 3 months, which will be the Monster Hunter returning once again with revised from what it's been over the last 18 months. I don't know what that will look like yet because we're working on it. But I'm very excited for people to see that. We're hoping to do later in the year leading up to the actual Kickstarter, new transformations as a playtest. I don't know what those will be yet because we're still working it out. And we're hoping to do the heritage system, which was featured initially in Aurora, authored by Sean and Scott Fitzgerald Gray, authoring that in Aurora. Then it got ported over into Valakin Clans, and we want to broaden it out to the broader Grimhollow setting. On top of all of that, those three playtest packets that we hope are coming out in the next couple months, leading up to October, we're hoping to do more streams, more discussions, kind of more publicly show off what we're working on. If this seems a little bit vague right now in terms of like, I don't know, we're hoping to do this, we're hoping to do that, it's because we're trying to balance putting stress on the team and making promises, but also showing you what the development process is kind of like here at Ghostfire. So we're hoping to do more discussions.
James was really hyped and excited for playtest packet. And I was really hyped and excited for, yeah, let's do like promotional content.
It's your wheelhouses. Yeah. It's your two wheelhouses.
I love the way the playtest packets like build community, right? It's like, I'm usually too busy to be in the Ghostfire Discord channel these days. I really made an effort. I make an effort for like 2 week, 2 month sort of like sprints. And then I'm like, I can't keep this pace up. And I vanish completely. But like every time I dive into the Ghostfire community on the Discord, I have like a wonderful time. And to really bring all of those threads together in a playtest, like that's the way to do it. Because it gets people all sort of clued in on the same thing. People are all sort of picking at the same problem, talking about the same like new design things. And so seeing that happen over at MCDM and in the sort of broader D&D community, though it's generally more diffuse over there, Kobold Press, I want to see Ghostfire do that because I know how cool this community is.
Similarly, I love the way that streaming with the game makers builds community. No, I everything that James said, but about the streaming, I think it's really cool and clever, in my opinion, to open those channels.
Not going to lie, we are kind of following in step of some other creators in the space that have done similar things because it seems cool to really engage the community in that way, get them involved, find out where the pain points are. You know, I've been speaking to Dan Dillon. I got to speak to him at PAX Unplugged about the processes that he was going through at Wizards and how to use playtest feedback appropriately. Even from, though I haven't spoken to James Intricasso directly about this, kind of speaking to Roman about their approach to playtesting, hearing where the pain points are and not necessarily having the community design for you, but finding the commonalities in how to improve something that's not working currently. And it's a fun process. And we have feedback from the last 18 months of the Monster Hunter kind of being public as well, that we're going to be drawing upon for this next version of it coming out in the not too distant future. So, keep an eye on that for future.
Yeah, to be clear, we've always been playtesting at Ghostfire.
Yeah.
Joe Rosso and I, over the last couple months, have several times gotten together and talked through playtest feedback that we've received from our playtesters. So this is just an extension of a process we already have. But as Dale and James both say, it's a great community builder as well. And the more you can make people feel a part of it, the more ownership they have in the final product. So, you know, we want that to be a part of this process as well.
Up till now, playtest involvement has largely been limited to Kickstarter backers. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. We sort of do a playtest period after Kickstarter when the books are kind of being developed from that initial concept stage into what they'll finally be out to the public. And so this is, we will still do that on the Grimhollow book, I imagine. So this is just extending the process earlier, as well as providing that kind of that fine polishing kind of after the fact as well. Keep in touch with this Twitch channel, because we'll be doing more streams here, and we're doing stuff over on the YouTube channel as well in terms of, you know, giving thought process, and not just for players either. You know, there's things that we want to put. We don't know what this book is going to be yet. Again, that's part of the process that we want to take you all on. You know, we have GM tools in mind as well that we want to introduce, and things from earlier versions of Grim Hollow that we want to refine. So all that good stuff to look forward to over the next 6 to 8 months. Speaking of many things, the Deck of Many Things is still suffering production issues, or is it?
Wizards announced that there were production issues and that they were going to fix it. And apparently they reached out to people, especially shops and other suppliers who had already received or were about to receive the defective products, and said, don't give out these products. We will send you replacements. And they still gave out those products. We have the corrupted products going out to folks. Wizards is aware of it. They have said so publicly. And if you did get a defective product, let them know and they will replace it. And go back to the store you bought it from, because the store should not have been selling you things that they were told not to by Wizards of the Coast directly.
Well, I think this speaks as well to a bit of a misunderstanding on how Amazon works. Because a lot of this was coming from people purchasing through Amazon and then giving a poor review to the product via Amazon. And we got an email not that long ago. I'm not going to remember the emailer's name. I apologize. But they were disgruntled because there was an edition of, I want to say it was the Planescape book. So it was a special edition that Wizards had said was for mom and pop kind of brick and mortar gaming shops only. Sorry, was it the way I said mum and pop? Was that what upset you, Dale?
Carry on.
And this edition was found on Amazon. And this emailer was sort of a bit disgruntled that, hey, Wizards had promised that this was only going to be for local retailers, and yet now I'm finding it on Amazon. What gives? Is Wizards of the Coast pulling a Swiftie here on us again? And correct me if anybody's got a different understanding, but my understanding of the way Amazon works is, yes, there are Amazon warehouses, but also retailers are free to list their products on Amazon and sell them through that avenue.
For the listeners, we are nodding.
I'm making an assumption here, a little bit of an assumption here, but basically I would assume the way that that collector's edition is being sold through Amazon is that a brick and mortar or some sort of retailer received it from Wizards and now are selling it through Amazon themselves, because they can reach more people that way than just folks that are going to walk into their store.
That is correct.
Confirmation from the field. All right, that is correct, which appears to be what's happening with the Deck of Many Things, which is unfortunate, you know, for folks. So it's really soured me on that product. Dale, you got a copy of it. As far as I know, your copy wasn't defective, but you still weren't a huge fan.
My copy wasn't defective. There's a lot about it that I do like, and there's a lot about it that I'm frustrated by. It's one of those things where I think there was so much potential in the product.
Sure.
And I can feel like, I don't know how to describe it, like the reins that are on the designers in some ways, because for me, the book that came with it that I was expecting to be the part that I was less interested in was my favorite part, where they would go through and they'd be like, oh, here's, I don't know, the key card or whatever. And they'd just give you a ton of like adventure hooks or like encounter concepts. Like they would give you just a ton of stuff that is like, I don't know, here's a bunch of ideas we had, run with it if you want to. And that was really, really cool. I was frustrated that it felt like more time could have been given to all of the additional cards that had been added in. I don't know off the top of my head. I have not memorized the Deck of Many Things. I could tell which cards were from the original Deck of Many Things because conceptually I was like, oh, that makes sense as a card, versus some of them that would be like, I don't know, like it's a tree. and then no deeper kind of symbolic elements went into the art or the concept of that card. And that I don't know, just it was kind of a letdown for me. So as a product, it's actually fine, but I was excited for it to be more than it was because I think it could have been more than it was.
Gotcha.
So particularly Dale hates if horses. And
I hate
trees.
Horses, trees. Yeah, all. What's going on here? We're going to keep a list. Okay. But no, I particularly, I think this is one where they really could have let the designers off the leash. And if they had the time and the sort of backing to really give this a lot of their focus, I think they would have made something really, really good. And I'm kicking rocks with my frustration that that's not what happened. Rapper Wombat says Dale only likes city worlds and rats.
Time for a rebrand.
You must just hate Cinderella because those rats got turned into horses.
Oh, what worst. A nightmare.
You were waiting for midnight. You were like, couldn't come fast enough. Get those horses back to being rats. Here's my question about Cinderella. Why did her shoe not just disappear?
Is this the direction we're going in?
Interesting. Did her...
That's very Marvel cinematic, like, pothole logic there, like modern cinema logic.
Did her outfit change back or did she get to keep the dress? I don't remember.
Well, I think the shoe surely remained because it fell off of her, right? I think everything she was wearing turned back. I think she lost the other shoe.
She wasn't wearing the horses, or did they stay as horses? Oh, that's like, true. Did she wear the carriage by being inside?
We will have to wait for the other shoe to drop.
All right, back on track.
Don't make me do it again. Don't make me do it again.
Speaking of peculiar things... You know, James, how you just love D&D.
I say this every day.
You love tabletop games in general.
Many people are saying this.
And are you a big fan of the Forgotten Realms?
Oh, down to my blood.
That's intense. How would you love to strap a computer to your face and enter the Forgotten Realms?
Sign me up for that VR juice. How can I do such a thing?
Well, not right now, but at some predetermined time in the future that has not yet been made public, a Swedish-based or Sweden-based developer named Resolution Games has been licensed by Wizards of the Coast to create a VR game that will take place in the Forgotten Realms. This is going to sound tangential, but it's related. Has anybody used VR? Yeah.
Yeah. In my digital media classes at various points, they would bring in the VR goggles and we'd all have a go. It was an interesting situation because I feel like you're handed an Oculus Rift and everyone's like taking turns with it. This is a pre-COVID time. Things were different. But everyone's, you know, taking their turn with the Oculus Rift. And so trying to get it so that it is adjusted properly for your eyes and your skull was always a nightmare. And if it's even slightly off, everything feels off and it really amplifies any sort of tendency towards motion sickness.
Well, let me tell you something. I'm not a huge VR proponent, but I have used it before. I was chatting with some other game designers about a week or two ago. We were getting distracted from what we were actually supposed to talk about. And we were talking about the Meta Rift 3, which is what the Oculus Rift has become. And it apparently is a revelation. It has these forward-facing cameras that allows it to really track the real world around you so they can like bound your space properly. Its internal cameras are much better, so its motion sickness is reduced. Probably not eliminated. I would probably still limit the amount of time I spend in VR just for my own safety, my own, you know, physical well-being. But it seems like VR games are getting really good right about now. Like, I point to Half-Life Alyx in particular.
Oh, yeah.
That was an amazing game. I don't usually play a lot of VR, but that game rocked.
Have you played Demio, which is the other game from Resolution Games?
No, I got to be honest, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, okay. Neither had I before this news broke. But I've watched a couple of videos of Demio being played, which I believe was a 2021 game. And then they've just recently in 2023 brought out like a competitive version of it. And it looks kind of like a virtual tabletop, in all honesty. It kind of looked like it reminded me of like Descent or Star Wars Imperial Assault or something like that, where it's kind of a dungeon crawling tabletop game, for want of a better word, because it's a VR game. But it's included a lot of like the classic D&D classes like Bard, Barbarian, Fighter, Ranger, I believe, Wizard off the top of my head. And they sort of function as you would expect those things to function. And then you fight through, I think it's like three levels of a dungeon before you fight the final boss in turn-based dice rolling. Like there's a digital dice that you use your VR hands to pick up and throw through the dungeon. So it's all very tactile feeling. It looked cool. I was just wondering if anybody had tried it.
I think VR is going to get really big in the next 10 years. Sometime in the next 10 years, because it feels like the tech is finally starting to break through and people are figuring out how to design for it now. It felt like a lot of early VR was just kind of flailing around trying to figure out what people actually would have fun playing. But now there's there's Resident Evil games in VR. There's a Half-Life game in VR. It feels like people are starting to figure out what is good.
The other thing is that for the first, I don't know, decade of the tech, we've been really focused on like, okay, let's make a game for VR. And it felt like when 3D movies came out and everyone was like, and here's a moment of the film that's just for 3D, which is a great pet peeve of mine. But, you know, it's that thing where they'll be like, here's a game for VR. It involves a lot of you standing still and then clicking the button in various directions, sometimes turning around. Whereas now we're getting to the points where, you know, simultaneous to this, we've got the announcement through, I don't know, some subsidiary of Disney where they've figured out the floor that really reacts when you're walking, so you don't have to stand still anymore. But then that's, of course, it doesn't seem to be aimed at this stage at like a thing that you personally own in your home for personal use. But it is interesting to see them still working on that when pre-COVID they had kind of VR spaces that were being set up for that kind of stuff, but got shut down because they couldn't, abide by COVID safety standards when everyone has to, you know, hand off their goggles and whatever.
This is the thing my friends and I were chatting about, and I don't know how applicable to all games this is. Like, you definitely couldn't do Half-Life Alyx in this way, but the game they were talking about, and I wish I could remember the name, basically scanned the area you were in and, like, adjusted its environments to fit onto that floor space you had available, like a holodeck.
Nice.
So it had you walking around a house, basically, and it started you off in a room that was like the room you were in, but maybe just a little bit smaller. And then when you left the room, you found yourself in a hallway that could lead to another room. And it was all smoke and mirrors keeping you in the exact space that you had scanned, the dimension of the space you had scanned that you were playing in. So you could be walking around in full motion and feeling like you were going basically anywhere. But they had a lot of little tricks. And the main one is that they kept you confined within a house, right? You weren't walking onto an open field. But they could sort of use dream geometry, false geometry, to keep you within that space the entire time you were within the house. And it just seems like a fantastic
Michael's right, bringing up augmented reality overlay, right? It's the pairing of augmented reality with what we've been calling virtual reality in a very intelligent way.
Yeah, I'm very cynical about VR, particularly because I was, really invested in the video game kind of news and industry in the way that a lot of people who listen to this podcast are with tabletop games. When VR was kind of breaking out in, was it like 2016, 2017, I want to say, and it was like, oh, in a couple of years, people won't have TVs. They'll only be playing their video games on VR. And it kind of seemed like it might have gone that way. But VR, to me, I don't know. I just can't see, especially because the big issue I think they need to cross. Good VR games to me seem like good mobile games in the way that they're designed for that platform.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually an issue for me if you don't like those sort of games.
Well, it's also an interesting thing to bring up, right? Because one of the biggest hurdles to VR as a format is that there's a huge kind of investment up front in order to participate in it.
Yeah.
Where the thing that we did side by side, we would do the Oculus Rift, and then you would make these kind of cardboard little housing cradles and put your phone in. And there were VR style games that you would put your phone in right in front of your face. And everyone has a phone, of course. But it does mean that then you are limited to what the phone is capable of doing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this balancing act of like, do you get the really good tech that can do the really fancy, incredible stuff, but it's very expensive and there's not that many games that it supports yet? Or do you go the cheap way, do it with the phone that everyone can access?
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my other point, is it's kind of an investment barrier, because you need a computer that's or a console that's powerful enough to run the hardware in the first place and the software, and then the VR headset on top of that. And then there's the physical storage barrier, right? Of like, where do I put this thing? They always are very conspicuous in a TV unit when someone's got their VR headset just kind of sitting on the edge of their TV or whatever.
You got to lean into it, right? You got to make it a centerpiece. You got to get like a little head that you put it on, dress it on, like, you know, you're resting a wig on it, you know?
Yeah.
The Eldritch Lorecast does not condone decapitation.
Now, there's an idea for a Necromancer's dungeon, is it's their VR head and it's just a zombie head kind of like looking around itself. We keep him occupied.
Did you guys ever read Dorothy of Oz, one of the like second or third L. Frank Baum Oz novels? They go to the land of Ev. There was a creepy Disney movie based off of it. But the character I'm thinking of, Princess Languidier, is a legitimately frightful character that I think
Return to Oz is a film.
Yeah, Return to Oz is a film.
That part's really scary.
That part's really scary. Just the idea of a sorceress who has like a hall of heads that she can replace with.
Oh, yes, I think I have. Yeah. Is this the movie with the bike people?
The Wheelers.
Like, not Wheelers.
Terrify people. Yeah.
Rewatch it, Ben. It actually, in my opinion, it holds up, in my opinion. There's like a couple silly things that you won't like because you don't enjoy fun. But but mostly you'll appreciate the creepy
Touché.
Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Touche. Well, speaking of creepy, Forgotten Realms coming out in VR at some point in the future. And then last but not least, I mean, this was kind of, it's barely even a news story, but it's kind of following up on something we talked about very briefly last year, which is that Rebel Moon, the apparently very flawed Zack Snyder movie, from what I have heard. I have not seen it. It had an RPG that was going to be tied to it, which was coming from Evil Genius. Then the deal fell through. Netflix claimed that Evil Genius had publicly displayed artwork that was not approved for the project and therefore cancelled the contract. Evil Genius then sued Netflix for the work and time investment they'd already put into it, and that Netflix were breaching the contract by trying to cancel it. That lawsuit has been ended amicably. The details of the settlement are not public, if there was technically a settlement, or the agreement between them has not been made public. But Evil Genius did say that they have an unspecified sci-fi tabletop RPG coming with more details in the future. So I guess they just sanded off all the serial numbers, all the Rebel Moon stuff, got rid of the fake lightsabers, and now it's okay to just use it as something else. That's what I'm assuming. That's
called Lunar Gorilla.
I'd
play Lunar Gorilla, but only if it was about monkeys or about apes.
Right. Is this a good time to mention that I genuinely don't like apes?
See, I'm talking about like horses? Guerrilla warfare, not...
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, okay. I'm talking about guerrilla warfare.
Oh, yes. That's,
give
that's
that gorilla a gun.
You would be a fan of the Andy Serkis trilogy, War of the Planet of the Apes. That is a great... three movies. That's the news. Diving into listener emails, this week, another email from Sean. I cannot confirm. I think the last three Sean emails we've had have been from at least two Seans. They could have been from three Seans, with our fourth Sean here on the episode to help answer these questions. Sean's question is retreat mechanics in 5th edition. And I want to know your opinions on this as well, because this is something I've struggled with in my games. Retreating in 5e is notoriously difficult. Most players don't even tend to consider it as an option once they're committed to a fight. And mechanically, because of the way the turn order works and the action economy, it can be incredibly difficult to retreat from a fight and get away from danger without some sort of huge negative penalty. Often one party member has to stay behind to basically tank the damage while everybody else uses their actions to dash and run away. If you were to design or even use the established mechanics, a way to put retreat into 5e and make it a viable option, what would you do? And I just, my Ben Byrne little amendment to this also includes kind of surrender mechanics, particularly for NPCs. I think it's a problem that the NPCs have a real hard time surrendering because the players are like, all right, they'll throw down your weapons, and then they throw down their weapons, give up their turn, and then the players spend another turn wailing damage onto them. So how do you go about, let's say, retreat first? Let's start there.
It's an interesting question in a game that's simulationist, where every square is counted and all of movement is counted. You know exactly how far you are away. To then break out of that mode of play into a more abstract mode of play where you want to say, regardless of the situation, we need to be able to retreat. Or you as the DM, regardless of the situation, I need the monster to get away. And abstract a system after working in such a granular system. But if you want it to work in 5e, that's what you need to do. It's easier to do in more abstract systems where you can, and this is what I would do if I had to make one for 5e, is to make a table with modifiers and say, these are the checks that you need to make if you want to retreat. If you have these certain things, or if it's this certain situation, there's a bonus, or here are some penalties to that, and make it something that can still be done, but you have to leave some element of strategy to it, which is where you put those modifiers in. To actually do it would take time, but I would, something along the lines of, if you're trying to stop the monsters from escaping, from fleeing, okay, we're going to make a check. And for every character that can do damage over 600 feet regularly, you get a +2 to the check. Right. If you have a creature whose speed is above blank in a round, including using bonus actions to dash, et cetera, you get a +blank. So that way you are rewarding people whose character could do the things while still making it abstract enough that it doesn't turn into an hour-long running battle as you try to work out distances and so on.
So D&D has this mechanic called chases. It is in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and it is hefty enough of a system that I think most players and DMs don't really worry about learning it because it's highly situational and relatively complex. And it also, I think to its discredit, uses a lot of custom creation for individual situations, because it has, like, a lot of its meat is made up of these complication tables of things that can happen during the chase. And it gives you some examples of, like, this is what could complicate a chase in a city. This is what complicated chase somewhere else. But there's no real universal complication table, which is probably a good thing, but it's also a bad thing because it means that you never want to bust out chase rules if you don't have a perfect complication table on hand. The D&D Adventurer magazine that I edit for the UK audience has had a couple of chases in its adventure series, and those basically reminded me that system exists, period. I think, can you hear that?
The drummer. Oh
my God.
Yeah, we sounds can. Like did horses. Somebody just murder a chihuahua?
The neighbor's dog. Someone's chasing the neighbor's dog. Anyway, back at it. And the chase rules can be adapted to other things, right? Like, there are a lot of adventures that end with the dungeon collapsing behind them, right? Well, that's a chase against the wall of debris that's crushing down behind you, right? It's a good abstract system for getting out of that count your grid squares mindset. It's just a matter of getting the DMs to think that way, and for the players, honestly, to accept moving from the highly regimented grid-based combat into something more abstract. Because you're absolutely right, Sean. I agree 100% that switching from one highly structured mechanical mode to a slightly different one is way more confusing than switching from sort of freeform talk play into the highly abstracted or the highly mechanicalized combat play. doing a half measure, I don't think I've ever met anyone who really clicks with it immediately.
When I think about this, so the idea of retreat or surrender, you have to make it a choice that the players can make. Mm. And then you have to incentivize making that decision, right? And so I'm trying to think of other games that have adequately sort of gamified that process of, do I stay or do I go? The one that immediately comes to mind is, of course, poker, right? You've got your options. Do you bet? Do you stay where you are? Or do you fold? It's a matter of cutting your losses, right? And that's a tricky thing when we're talking about a simulationist game like D&D, because you're dealing with, instead of it being some like one resource, right? These are your tools that you have to win the game, this hand that you've been dealt, versus, you know, how much money you have, which, you know, think of that like hit points or whatever, right? But you've got in D&D a much wider range of tools at your disposal. You've got much more complicated scenarios at play. And when you're talking about hit points versus money, every dollar you lose is a dollar. Like that is an important thing to keep in mind, versus hit points, as Abria would say, the only one that matters is the last one. Mm-hmm. There is no functional difference between having one hit point and having 20 hit points, 100 hit points. And so it becomes a really difficult thing to really impress upon a player that idea of risk and reward. If I stay, I get the reward, but I risk my character dying, whatever. If I leave, I don't get the reward, but I get to stay alive. But you don't feel it the same way that you do if you are at a poker table. And I think that's a very, very difficult thing to translate across to something that is so detailed and simulationist. And I don't know how I would do it.
This speaks to the interconnected complexity of systems like this. I wonder if you could accomplish that by assigning monetary value to hit points. At a long rest, it costs you a certain amount of supplies to heal. That might get people to think.
Baldur's Gate kind of does that.
Oh, yeah, with the camp supplies. I've never had to worry about that, but yeah, totally.
But neither have I. They usually just find them around the place. But yeah, Varys, the GM. Said that they ask their player characters to expend a number of resources such as spell slots or items equal to the remaining adversary's combined CR. And if they do, they simply escape, which I think is maybe kind of what you're talking about there, James, where it's like, all right, here's a resource expense that we've kind of used to disengage almost from the combat.
That's sort of it. I mean, I'm more to what Dale was talking about is just that players don't really value their hit points, right? The only hit point that matters is the last one. So if you assign a value to not getting KO'd or assign a value to not taking terrible damage, then you might get people sort of considering their overall health more than just the last hit point.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's quite that players don't value their hit points at all, you know, above the first or second one. Because I think players can see their hit points going down on their character sheet and they can get alarmed that, oh I'm getting close to death and I don't know if I'm going to survive
that's
another
fair.
Round.
I should probably say the last hit is the only one that matters.
Mm. Sure.
So, of course, the extreme version of that is the last hit point is the only one that matters. But what matters is looking at your character sheet and going, if I take one more hit, I will go down.
Yeah, gotcha. But that, you know, I think it's more fun to be like, okay, well, I could go down, but I know my turn's coming before the adversaries, and then I know I've got another player who, if they can't heal me, maybe they can take out the adversary, and then the combat will be over and everything will be fine. So there's that further incentivization. Mm-hmm. And then kind of tied into that is the other issue I often find in combats, and I'm kind of hearing it or a question has been raised to me here, hearing your answers to this, which is like, when do you offer the opportunity to retreat? Is it only at the top of the round, like a new round of betting in poker? Or is it at any point that the players kind of agree they want to retreat? But therein lies the other problem, which is some players, even if it's a bad situation, even if it's like, you know, they are facing certain death, at least one or two players dying, if not a TPK, if they continue this combat. Some players will want to stick in because they just want the fun of the combat, or they're like, no, don't worry, we'll make it through, I've got a plan. And some players desperately want to get out, and some players it's what my character would do. And that kind of social discourse within the group can make it really hard to retreat as well, even if it's the optimum choice.
That's exactly it. There's you know, this ideal version of reality where the players would be the ones choosing when they raise the thing, like you as a DM never having to be like, remember, you're allowed to retreat, right? But there is all this history of gaming that I think has trained us to want to keep fighting. It is fun to keep fighting. This is an issue, weirdly, with Marvel Snap as well, right? There's this core mechanic in Marvel Snap, which is that you bet more cubes if you think you're going to win, right? And so it intends to kind of have this bluffing element like poker. But the thing is that at poker, it's a game of deception. It's played over a long period of time. Dealing with percentages and all these things. Marvel Snap, you don't have any of that actual bluffing element. It's kind of just, well, do you want to finish playing the fun game, or do you want to do the safe thing and leave, which is not fun? And I think it's very similar in D&D, where it's like the fun thing to do is this thing that is higher risk. And that's, it's, you know, Roman in chat asked me, how did you feel about the retreat in Dusk? So I was in a streamed game with MCDM called Dusk. There was a particular session where we got way in over our heads in a combat, and we did have to retreat, and we had to make that call. We didn't want to. We retreated much later than we should have. And honestly, the way I felt about it, if my character hadn't, I mean, it's more complicated than this. One character died, and my character got kind of banished to a dark shadow dimension. If my character hadn't been banished to a dark shadow dimension, I would have been annoyed that we'd left. If that other character hadn't died, I would have been annoyed that we'd left. Like that is just how the game feels to me, and I'm sure to a lot of other players as well. It's this really fun story beat, right? The tragic bear escape. It's a really great story beat when it plays out that way. But if it plays out even slightly different to that, if everyone manages to escape and is up on their feet, there's a feeling of like,
I mean, the flip side of this is also when the villain or the monster wants to escape, and this is often like GM advice that I see online along the lines of the monsters know what they're doing, which is like, fights shouldn't be to the death. People should try to run away constantly. Like animals, once they, you know, a beast, once it's taken damage and it knows that the target is too dangerous to be able to get a feed out of it, he's going to run away. Goblins know that they're cowardly. They should run, blah, 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 blah. Players hate monster retreats in my experience, to the point where I think I've brought this up on the Lorecast before, but one of the famous examples of monster retreat at my table is when it was a group of dwarven bandits and one of them tried to run away, and I wanted to hand wave. I wanted to say, okay, and he runs off, he gets away, mainly because I didn't want to draw it out, right? And one player was like, I follow him, and because I know he can only move 25 feet, I stay exactly a distance from him that he can't get close enough to me to get into melee, but I can firebolt him for as long as he's running away. And we did like one or two rounds of it before I just was like, you get him, whatever, you got him. Like,
that's not just D&D players either, by the way. I've had exactly that thing happen in a game of Fate.
Right. Yeah. Get the points. You know, I want to be Mario. I want to collect all the coins, kind of, you know, that instinct in gaming to kill all the monsters, to get the highest score you can.
It goes to just human nature. When I was working on Peril and Pinebrook for beginners and for kids, we were debating about whether we should be able to kill creatures. And so one suggestion was, why don't we just have the monsters run away? And I said, because as soon as they run away, they will be chased. And then we're turning a 1 hour adventure into a 4 hour adventure as we watch characters chasing monsters all over the map, because that's what people do. They don't want the monster to get away.
They want narrative resolution, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, killing them is a pretty final way to end a scene.
That is true. All right, with all this, and you might be repeating your answer, but I'm just curious to try and, because there's been a lot of theory crafting in this conversation. Let's go in reverse order. I'll start with Dale. how do or have you, like, if you had players that wanted to retreat in your game right now, how do you think you would handle it?
If they wanted to retreat, I would probably give the bad guys one round of thing to do to get in the way and then let narrative take over. I think for me, it's unlikely enough that my players are going to make that decision that they want to retreat, that I don't want to punish them for making that decision. I think at that point, it's like, yeah, okay, you get out. But, you know, I would want there to be like, I don't know, there has to be a yes, but kind of quality to it to make it feel narratively interesting.
I kind of like that, though. I like the idea of, like, if the players retreat, the monster gets one more turn and then they get away. If the monster retreats, the players each get one more turn and then the monster gets away, which, given how the action economy is stacked, will probably mean the death of that monster. But, you know, but it depends on what the monster is. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Get out of here.
Well, that actually sounds like how most JRPGs do it, where retreat or run is like a command. And yeah. It's like, that's your action for that turn. And usually in those games, you have to make some kind of check. But I think with Dale, I would just like saying I want to get away and then having it fail is never particularly fun.
Depends on the situation. Does the monster want the characters to get away? If so, they get away. Would the monster want nothing to do with the characters getting away because of blank reason? Then they will be chased. I would still give them a chance to get away. I think making a check, or as Dale said, you know, giving some sort of yes, but you can, but you're going to have a level of exhaustion. You can, right. But I need you. You're going to try to run away. Give me an athletics check. You're trying to sneak away. Give me a stealth check. You are trying to use your magic to cause a distraction. Give me an arcana check. Let their skills and the choices that they're making feed the story and allow for the outcome that they're looking for.
You've given me an idea there of melding these two ideas, which is, you know, each party member to escape needs to do one action or make one ability check to escape. If they don't, the monster gets one attack on them, as opposed to, like, let's say it's a dragon. The dragon doesn't get both claw attacks and a bite attack and use its breath weapon. It gets, right, like, one claw attack so that they take the damage, but they're not going to get, you know, deleted for failing the check necessarily. And then they can remake the check if they still want to try to get away. Interesting question. All right, let's do this last question quickly, because it's almost like a top of the episode question coming in from Murray. You are in charge of 5.5e. What mechanic from the current edition of 5e are you cutting? Ability scores, armor classes, examples, retreat mechanics, chase rules.
10 levels off the top.
Oh, I like it. Let's do it.
Let's scrunch them into 10 levels. 10 levels worth of progression. Hell, make 10 levels worth of spells. Make cantrips, yeah, okay, your first level spells or something.
I like it. I'm there. I'm there already. Let's do that. I don't even need a scrunch. Just a snip would be nice.
For me, first instinct is, I'm either getting rid of ability scores or skill bonuses, one or the other. Mm-hmm. More and more as I mature, I feel like we don't need both. We don't need both. This feels like a holdover from the past. This is a lot of numbers to be throwing at new players. It's a lot of numbers for me to be remembering. I understand why they're there. I understand why and how they work. I don't think we need both.
Well, you've taken my ability scores. You've taken my skills. So,
what will you do with these creative constraints, Sean?
I know. I'm going to say get rid of inspiration and rerolls or anything of that nature. I think that sort of currency in a game works best with games where there is a large threat if you fail specific checks. 5e does not have that. Maybe at first level, but it doesn't really have that. It doesn't need rerolls. It doesn't need inspiration. It doesn't need that currency.
I don't know what I would cut. I feel like I just want to add things, to be honest, or slightly twist things.
Let's turn the question on its head. What would you add to the D&D system then?
The School of Clemency as the healing school of magic. That is what I would add, and put a lot of healing spells into that school as opposed to necromancy. and a vacation for that matter.
Yeah. I remember the D&D Next playtest where they just could not decide if Cure Wounds was evocation or necromancy. It kept going right back and forth. It was pretty funny to watch. this is what I would add. I would add a mechanic for all spellcasters to be able to, on short rest, recover a certain baseline threshold of their lowest level spells.
Right, okay.
Because I keep thinking about, while playing Baldur's Gate, how my adventuring day ends when my spellcasters are tapped out. It doesn't happen in my home campaign, for some reason. probably just the pace of my dungeons. I don't think I give them the opportunity to run all the way down to empty. But in Baldur's Gate 3, it happens all the time. And if a short rest could always replenish like everyone's first level spells, or always replenish everyone's first or second, depending on, you know, level thresholds as they get higher and higher, I wouldn't feel like I was totally out of juice. I would feel like, hey, let's just keep having Shadowheart use Guiding Bolt. Let's just keep doing that. And then I'll bust out the six level spells when I really, really need to. And, you know, the more I talk about this is just at will encounter and daily powers. This is just fourth edition. And yeah, that just goes to show that I think fourth edition had some great, great design stuff in it. It just didn't communicate its ideas in a particularly appealing way.
What I add is tricky. I don't know exactly specifically, but I think I would add something to the backgrounds system, because I think that's a part of 5e design specifically that I'm like, this is a good idea, but it needs a little oomph, a little push, a little something extra.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
After removing inspiration, I would add positive conditions such as inspired. And only when you have certain positive conditions can you use certain bits of your class, background, whatever. And so you would be working with other players to get those positive conditions, which would allow you to do cool things.
Mmm, tasty.
If only we worked at a gaming company where we could like put these additions into the game somewhere.
Boy, I'll tell you, I wish. Maybe someday.
Oh, well. All right, I've got a super quick question here from Michael J. Pastor, who asked it in the Discord, in the Twitch chat, because I suspect I know the answer to this. It's a quick rapid-fire question. Sean Merwin, what is your experience with 3D printers?
Absolutely none whatsoever.
That's what I expected. James Haig, what is your experience with 3D printers?
Highly minimal.
Okay. All right. There's a little bit more than I was expecting necessarily. Dale Kingsmill, what's your experience with 3D printers?
Also pretty minimal, but I did have a class where I was part of a group where we 3D printed a drone.
Ooh, that's a cool thing to 3D print. Yeah, I 3D printers for me sit in the same brain spaces, VR and an airbrush, a very expensive hobby unto themselves. With that, thanks for the question, Michael J. Pastor. Thank you for all your questions. If you've emailed in or hung out with us here on Twitch, you can join us. We are here every week on Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, or it's Tuesday, 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. And we do stream across the globe, I assume, at different times, so you can find those out. You can also hang out with us on YouTube, on iTunes, on Spotify. We're in all those places. Comment, subscribe. They help us grow. We appreciate anyone and everyone who has come and hung out with us over the last 2 years. That's right. It's been 2 years of doing this podcast. And you can send emails also, which was what I was originally saying, to podcast@ghostfiregaming.com, and I will take them and I will read them, and then we will plug them into our experts, and like the back computer, we will get out replies. And that's
this
how
is
that
good.
Works.
This
yeah,
is good.
This is good. You're enjoying this outro? Yeah, great. I learned from the best. All right. My name is Ben Byrne, here with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Haig, and we will be back next week for another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
Like the sousaphone you're bringing in, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Somebody needs to get the timpani.
I'm bringing the Mahler's Third Symphony hammer.
What a high-pitched sounding name for an instrument, the timpani.
The timpani.
for such a low sound that instrument makes.